we saw Gosene Odidki Donko and Echi. Long ago, the winters were tough, very hard. We survived them long ago, and we survived them to this day. Given here in these songs, the tribe sings for you, Winter Storm.
Hi, you're listening to Indian World on your community radio station, KBOO, 90.7 FM here in Portland, and you can get us up the gorge and also down in the valley, and we just hope that you have something to write with, because there's always something you'll want to make a note about somewhere along the line. And we have a guest today who's going to talk about a new book that she's authored, and we have John Mackey on the way, and Louis Shoah's over here behind me, watchdogging the engineering end of things. So, and we still have another person coming in a little later. So let's go on with another piece of music, and that was Winter Storm from a group called The Tribe, T-H-A Tribe, and their album is called Winter Storm. And don't ask me how this next one is properly called, but it looks like Fibo Hate No More, whatever that means. You know, we don't know all the languages. There's too many of them out there. And in case you would like to speak with us here in the air room, we can only speak to you when the music is playing, and our phone number is 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. For general business, call the front desk, please, at 503-231-8032. Let's go back to some music. Yes, the group known as The Tribe. And once again, that's something I'm not sure about the pronunciation. Fibo Hate, I don't know. But Fibo Hate No More, or Fibo Hate No More. And it doesn't explain what that means. But we will move on to another musician called Tiger Tiger. An album is called Southern Exposure. Let's see what Tiger Tiger has to offer. Yeah, Tiger, Tiger, and that was Lay Your Burden Down. Tiger, Tiger, judging by the name, is from the southeast and probably Seminole Creek or one of those nations. And this is one we haven't played that much. We've played a little bit of it here and there, but it's something we haven't played for a while, so I thought it'd be nice to hear it again. Well, we picked up a copy of the January 15th edition of Smoke Signals and saw a great big picture of our buddy Ed Edmo on there. And the headline is Putting Stories on the Wind. And that's very close to what we kind of named ourselves here as Talks on the Wind. The thing is that Ed has many faces, and he has faces as a writer, an actor, a poet, a lecturer, many, many different things. And he's had his ups, he's had his downs. He's really a man of the people and a man who loves the Northwest. And a while back, a long time ago, something came up. We were lecturing together somewhere, and somebody made mention of Salado Falls, and he started to cry. The memory of Salado was bittersweet for him. He loved it, and of course it was drowned some time back. And so when I picked up this copy of Smoke Signals, that was one of many thoughts in my mind. And Salado Falls is, the drowning of Salado Falls is one of the things we're going to be addressing here today. We have a woman with us who's from Portland State University. Her name is Katrina Barber, or Katie Barber. And I better turn her mic on so she can talk when she's ready. Katie, welcome to Indian World.
Thank you. Thank you.
What our audience is always interested to know is who our guests are. And part of who you are is what tribe are you? If you are native, if you're not native, then just say so. But people always want to know.
I'm not native.
Where are you from, though?
I grew up in Portland. Went to Jefferson High School, graduated in 88, went to Oregon State University, and then decided to go to Washington State University to continue my studies in American Studies.
Well, that's one thing. When you're an educator, you never get through with your studies, do you?
No, it's what I love about it.
Yeah, it's kind of a blessing and a curse, really. There's always more. But if there weren't more, then you'd have to find something else to do anyhow.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you wrote this book. Now, I was very pleasantly surprised to find your book was available. I welcome you to share a little bit of information about it. It's called The Death of Salado Falls, and it's published in paperback by Washington University Press, is it?
University of Washington Press,
University of Washington Press. And it's 248 pages. Well, we're into the bibliography there, but it's got a bunch of footnotes, a whole bunch of footnotes. So the book is a little shorter, but the notes are copious, and we know that she should know something about what she's talking about with this many references in the back here. She should have some idea. Now, I certainly want to ask you, among other things, up front, is what inspired you to write about this subject?
Well, like I said, I grew up in Portland. I'd heard stories about Salado Falls as a kid. One of my first memories is actually of buying a book by Martha McEwen. It was a children's book when I was about 8 or 9, called Linda's Indian Home. Some of you might know something about that book. It's a pictorial history of Celilo Village. And I bought that book, or my parents bought that book for me shortly after Flora Thompson had died. And the sales clerk told me that she knew Flora Thompson. And so I had some knowledge about Celilo Falls. When I was in high school, a couple of my teachers at Jefferson High School, Linda Christensen and Bill Bigelow, brought in Craig Leslie. He had just finished writing Winterkill, and we had just finished reading it as a class. And it was really exciting to have a real author come in and talk to us about the kinds of things that he liked studying and reading and writing about. When he came into the classroom, he brought a whole bunch of 8x10 photographs of Cook's Landing and of the So Happy encampment there. And I got really interested in what I thought of at the time as a sort of civil rights issue that was in my own backyard. Of course, I've since come to understand it as a treaty rights issue. So I got interested in high school in fishing rights and continued to study about them.
Well, you know, you brought up a couple of people's names there. Flora Thompson, we got to know a little bit. I didn't know her well, but I got to know her a little bit. We used to see her at some of the bow and arrow gatherings. And Craig Leslie, I didn't interview, but my, at that time, co-host, Spider Moccasin, interviewed him. And so you bring into the picture, Bill Bigelow rings a bell. You're bringing into the picture a number of people who have had some kind of contact with yours truly or Indian World. And we're going to be most interested to learn more about your book. I keep moving things around, and I wonder where they are. What was the Celilo area like in the 1950s?
Well, in the 1950s, it was an area that was being fished by a lot of different groups of people. Some of them were the people who comprised the four treaty tribes on the Columbia River, the Yakima, Umatilla, Warm Springs, and Nez Perce. There are also Indians who are coming from the area to the area from other places like Montana and California. So in a lot of ways, it was a really busy and crowded place. Of course, it was adjacent to Celilo Village, which was an important village, fishing village in the area, an important Indian community. And Martha McEwen, the author of that children's book I mentioned earlier, called Celilo Village Oregon's oldest town because of how long people had been living there. Archaeological evidence suggests at least 11 or 12,000 years. Celilo Falls and Celilo Village in the 1950s was kind of under siege, though, because the Army Corps of Engineers planned to build the Dalles Dam and, of course, started construction in about 1953 and finished that construction in 1957. So it was a community and a place that was undergoing a tremendous amount of transformation during the 1950s.
Well, what led to the building of this? Oh, thank you. What led to the building of the Dalles Dam in 57?
Well, a lot of things. There are a lot of people who, for a very long time, imagined the Columbia River as a sort of tamed waterway that would be great for navigation. So even before the 1950s, before World War II, the Army Corps of Engineers had completed a number of studies that sort of reimagined the river as a series of lakes that would allow for easy navigability up and down the river. And, of course, all of those lakes would erase the falls and rapids that provided the important fishing sites from native people in the area. The 1948 flood that flooded Vanport added impetus for the building of the dams. World War II seemed to justify redefining the river as a hydroelectric river. And then the Cold War, the Army Corps of Engineers used the Cold War to further justify building dams like the Dalles Dam. But people in the Dalles, non-native people in the Dalles, were interested in the dam too because they thought that it would bring population to the city. They thought that it would bring industry to the city, and to some degree it did.
Well, your book also mentions, of course, the fishing industry. excuse me, I have a cold breaking up. And the book mentions the fishing industry naturally, and particularly noted by myself was Seufert Cannery. And I was trying to decide how to say it.
Seufert's, right?
All right, good. But it was a very large cannery, and not the only one, I gather. When the dam was built, that just kind of petered away, didn't it?
Yeah, the Seufert Cannery actually was the Army Corps of Engineers transformed the buildings that comprised the cannery into their headquarters, which was probably pretty painful for Francis and Arthur Seufert, who were running the cannery at the time. And the cannery didn't survive, of course, the building of the dam, in large part because the fishing industry at that particular area didn't survive the building of the dam.
Right. Well, you can't have it all ways. We've got hydroelectric power, or we've got fish.
Mm-hmm.
When I was going through the book, I noticed another thing that was very interesting. You mentioned a number of minorities. What are some of the other minorities besides Indians who were involved in fishing up there?
Well, the Seufert Cannery was bringing Chinese laborers from Portland seasonally to work at the cannery. Eventually, the use of Chinese laborers would decline, and they'd bring in Filipino and white women. That was around World War II and into the early 1950s. But, you know, the Dalles was actually a pretty diverse and vibrant community, and continues to be in terms of the ethnic and racial groups that live together there.
I never spent much time in that location, but maybe it's because it's too hot in the summer and too cold in the winter. Reminds me of the Dakotas in some respects. But the river is always interesting to me, and I wasn't originally from this area, or I am not originally from this area, although I've lived here for many, many years. And I just missed out on Celilo Falls because it was destroyed just before I got here. And we'll come back here in just a moment. But, John, would you play us a little Delphine Sinogini there on number 3?
Okay, John, here you go.
Thank you. Creator, I pray to you. This comes from your innermost being. Recognize us again. Take pity on us as people.
Sometimes things happen that you're not planning on, and a couple of things happen there. It's kind of comical. But I was just talking with the engineer, John Mackey, who's been plagued with a series of problems here lately, personal stuff. Sorry to hear your kid is sick, by the way. And we were trying to get the music reshuffled here so that both of us were on the same page. So I apologize for a little confusion there in the background. And we had to change microphones, so now you'll have a better understanding of what's going on back here. The book is Death of Celilo Falls, published by University of Washington Press. And Katie Barber here, or Katrina Barber, is talking with us about some of the aspects of the book that she finds important. What was the next thing that you wanted to mention? I think you said Native response?
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that I pointed out one of the things that I think is the most important part of this story, and that is that even though there was a, sort of this overwhelming movement to control the Columbia River through a series of dams that the Dalles Dam was one part of, that Native groups affected by the building of the Dalles Dam launched a series of protests against it. So the Army Corps of Engineers, beginning in 1946, started holding public hearings about the dam, and representatives from each of the four treaty tribes and from Celilo Village, from the Celilo Fishing Commission, would go to those meetings, and they'd use them as a forum to talk about what they would be losing when the Dalles Dam was built. They also passed resolutions in their tribal councils flatly against the building of the dam. They wrote letters to their government representatives expressing, again, their dislike of the plans for building the dam. And then they sent representatives to speak before Congress about what the effects of losing Celilo Falls and the rapids and eddies that comprised the Long Narrows, that segment of the river that was so important for fishing communities. So in all of those efforts, Native people were very vocal about what they would be losing, and very vocal about what they thought would be fair compensation. Of course, they didn't want the dam to be built in the first place. If it had to be built, they wanted to be compensated fairly for what they would be losing.
Yeah, one of the things that came up, speaking of being compensated for the loss of various rights and such, before the dam's construction, there were many fishing sites along the river. And part of the treaty said that there would be some in-lieu sites set up, some places to fish instead of where you used to fish, which would be there specifically for Indian needs. And they never, they did put a few in, but they never built all of the ones that they claimed that they would supply. And so that was another broken treaty right there. And just lately, I understand that Celilo Village is up for reconstruction. They're going to put some, well, almost anything would be better than the shacks that are there. People love the place, but they deserve some decent housing. And the longhouse has been redone, and that makes people very happy. But homes are much in order. So there are some things that have been done, some things that have not been done, according to the agreement. And
Interject just one thing.
Of course,
I think the rebuilding of Celilo Village is an interesting sort of ongoing issue. One of the things that happened with the building of the Dalles Dam was that a portion of Celilo Village was inundated, and so people had to be moved. About 30 families ended up being moved, and Ed Edmo, who you mentioned at the very beginning of the show, his father was on a committee that helped to move those people. So he was played an important role in that. The federal government at the time, though, thought that this would be a good time to dismantle Celilo Village if they could. So they offered people additional money if they were willing to move at least 10 miles from Celilo Village. They offered them, about $1,200 to replace their homes if they stayed in the village, another $500, so a significant amount of money more if they moved to someplace like the Dalles or Gresham or Portland. And so there was an effort then to move people out of that particular village.
Yeah, that's called relocation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that game has been played all too often, all over the Indian country. We're in conversation with Katie Barber here, and she is a professor at Portland State University and has written this book called The Death of Saliva Falls. Before we go further, tell our audience how they can find out more information, like where to purchase it and anything like that that you may want to discuss.
Well, the book is available at Powell's. They can also go to area bookstores. It should be available in most places. It's published by the University of Washington Press, so people can get it through the University of Washington Press website if they'd like. And if you'd like to reach me, you can reach me through my email address. Shall I give that?
Yes, please do.
It's Barber K, B-A-R-B-E-R-K, at pdx.edu. So Barber K at pdx.edu.
Well, in the near future, you're having a reading somewhere, too. Where is that?
On February 23rd, from noon to 1, I'll be talking at the EcoTrust building. I'll be talking at EcoTrust.
That's over in, what, Northwest 10th?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's in the Pearl District.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of stuff happening in the Pearl. Well, we're really happy that you had a chance to come here, and we don't want to have you leave yet, but we're going to play a little bit more music, and we'll come back to you and see what else you have to add.
It's gonna be all right. It's all right.
Yeah, we're in conversation here at Indian World with Katie Barber from Portland State University, and she's discussing her book, The Death of Celital Falls. And while we were playing music, one of our listeners called and had a question, and I'll let Katie talk about that.
The question was if the Dalles Dam were to somehow be removed or if the reservoir behind it was drawn down, would the falls still be there or what would be there? And you know, one thing to point out is that the Army Corps of Engineers did an awful lot of dynamiting of the bedrock that comprised the riverbed in an effort to create a place where they could actually build the dam. So a lot of what gave the river its characteristics through that particular about 9-mile stretch that Charles Wilkinson called the best fishing in North America was removed or was changed. So it's hard to say what would be there if
they call that the Long Narrows, did they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
mm-hmm.
what I thought I recalled. Well, yeah, that's a mystery, and I was just saying I didn't think it would ever happen because hydroelectric power is so valuable today, and what would you replace it with if you took it away? So I don't think that's going to happen in reality, no matter how much anybody wants it. Well, I'm going to ask you one more question here. Why do you think this history is important?
Well, I think it's important because it, in so many ways, reflects and parallels the kinds of relationships between Indian and non-Indian people in this region. And you think about earlier periods, and a lot of people know what happened to Native people in the area as a result of contact. There's a tremendous population decimation because of diseases. There are Native treaties that really took away a tremendous amount of property from Native people, placed them on reservations. Indian wars as a result of those treaties. I think that the transfer of resources of salmon to hydroelectricity from Native resources to non-Native resources in the 1950s follows that longer history of taking from Native people in the region. And it's a history that we continue to play out today in the relationships between Native and non-Native people. And I think of organizations like the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, which is a really important organization that is working on co-management issues on the Columbia River, and some of the things that thwart those the ability of Native people to enter into cooperative management of resources that that they continue to rely upon. And I see that as being very closely connected to this history as well.
Well, we've had some of the people occasionally. It's been a long time. We've had some of the people from what I playfully refer to as the Fish Kabish on Indian World in the past, and I was talking with Carol Craig, who was part of this big lecture series that revolved around Lewis and Clark, and it was interesting to hear her points of view about all these assorted issues, the importance of the fishing, and how important the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission was in not just preserving the fish, but enhancing the crop, both the native fish and the farm fish. Well, before you leave, is there anything else you'd like to add other than to remind them of your upcoming appearance at EcoTrust?
Well, if people would like to join me in a conversation about this, I will be at EcoTrust on February 23rd at the lunchtime hour, noon to 1. I'm really interested in hearing what other people remember about Celilo and why they think it's important. It's a shared history for people of this region. I guess the final thing I'll point out is you know, that treaty rights don't mean very much if what they protect is gone. So if you've got a treaty right to fish, it's an important right to have, but it doesn't mean very much if there aren't salmon to fish.
Well, that's a fact. Where I come from, our elders say, if you have hunting rights, hunt. Mm-hmm. If you have fishing rights, fish. If you have land rights, use the land and be prepared to defend it.
Yeah.
Well, we thank you very much, Katie, for your time and your contribution to Indian World. And any time you have something additional come up or you hear about something you think we'd be interested in, we hope to have you remember us. And again, thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed being here.
Anyway, let's hear from a local artist here, Isaac Trimble, from his album, Dedication.
This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 9th of February, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A newspaper run by students at Southeastern Oklahoma State University is under fire for what is being termed racist comments about Native Americans. SOSU claims the paper is independently run, although the university does pay an advisor to oversee the student columnists. Jason May, the Southeaster editor, says originally the controversy was over a column that was supposed to be humorous and satirical. May says the writer, Bo Chadwell, used racial slurs and the word savages to make a point.
I do regret that it was taken literally. We definitely didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings. He was trying to point out the negative stereotype that was being used. So in that sense, I do regret it. If we had to do it all over again, we probably would have worded it a little differently to make sure that it was understood.
Also at issue is a statistic May used in a subsequent editorial when responding to a Native America Times article on the controversy. He says the Times readers didn't complain about its reporting because, quote, 50% of Native Americans are at a below basic literacy rate, unquote. May says his source for that information is the National Institute for Literacy, a government program charged with identifying and increasing literacy rates in America. But an NIFL staff assistant says the organization does not list literacy statistics by ethnic groups, and that the most recent literacy surveys, compiled from other organizations and posted on the NIFL website, are from 1992. The NIFL says it does not believe in using the statistics as a way to stereotype or condone discrimination, as in the case of May's Southeaster editorial. The civil rights organization Indian Citizens Against Racial Exploitation, or ICARE, has issued a letter to SOSU President Glenn Johnson, asking him to review the articles for violations of the school's racial ethnic harassment policy. ICARE's co-chair, Peggy Larney, is a member of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma and director of the American Indian Education Program in Dallas.
We feel like that when a state university has been supported by taxes that we all pay for and the people in the city of Oklahoma pays for, and then they have supposed to be over 1,000 American Indian students attending there, and probably three-fourths of that is probably funded by a lot of the tribal nations through scholarship. That something needs to be said.
For its part, SOSU is reviewing the complaints, and Raquel Hutchins, chief of staff to President Glenn Johnson, says they've received many.
We have complaints from Native American people in the community and outside of the community, non-Native Americans, even, you know, our own president doesn't agree with what is being said in the newspaper.
Hutchins says the university will decide a course of action once they've reviewed the legal ramifications with the school's general counsel. In other news, in British Columbia, the controversial death of a Native infant 3 years ago has now sparked a formal investigation. Craig McCulloch reports from Vancouver.
The formal inquest started earlier this week, almost 3.5 years after the death of Sherry Charlie. The 19-month-old member of the Nuchanoth Band was murdered by her uncle, Ryan George. The young girl and her older brother were placed in the uncle's home by the band's child care agency without any background check. George had a previous criminal record for assault and is now currently serving a 10-year sentence for manslaughter in the child's death. The inquest will hear from George, representatives from the child care agency, and the provincial government. It will also look into why the brother was allowed to remain at the uncle's residence for 5 months after Sherry's death. The incident has become a hot political issue, with the provincial opposition alleging a cover-up of earlier reviews. One review that was released, heavily censored, listed several mistakes by both the provincial government and the Nuchanoth's child care agency. Critics say this new inquest will not solve the matter. They feel a formal public inquiry is needed to find out more and expose all of the facts. I'm Craig McCulloch in Vancouver.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. And by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Portland Community Community College would like to invite you to the 16th Annual African Film Festival honoring Black History Month at PCC's Cascade Campus. This year's festival will feature 28 political, historical, and socially charged films as seen through the eyes of Africans. The films will cover a wide range of themes and topics, from the African legacy in Mexico, women's ongoing struggle for equality and independence, to love across class lines and preservation of African cultural and artistic heritage. This cable co-sponsored festival will be free of charge and will cover a five-week period from February 3rd through March 4th. For more information, go to www.africanfilmfestival.org or call 503-244-6111, extension 3630.
Greetings, this is Contessa de la Luna. The Cable Board of Directors will meet this Friday, that's right, this Friday. Support and be an active member listener by attending the Cable Board of Directors meeting this Friday evening at 6 p.m., 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, one half block south of Burnside, darling. Kiss, kiss.
I think most black people in general are really not interested in dialogue at this point from white people. I think most black people see dialogue or the request of white people for dialogue as being basically analogous to stalling. Okay, stalling for time, like they say in the hostage dramas. I think what most black people would be, and it's and hostages is not an appropriate term here. I think what most black people would like from white people is some kind of action. Now you can do it while you talk to us. You can say I am reaching for my license. You can do that if you'd like, okay? Or you can just be quiet. I think what most black people, what most people from the Seneca Nation, what most people from the Mohawk Nation would like is some activity, massive amounts of it.
It is through action or non-action that we allow things to happen. We must put an end to the idea of allowing things to continue and not taking responsibility.
Tonaje, ichatam.
The ultimate stand is your commitment to do something with your life that will make a difference.
Soft piece. Okay, so I'm going to open the mic now. I guess I already had it open there. Well, I wanted to talk to Katie here for a second. She said that the gentleman on the telephone had something to say that was pertinent to our previous discussion about the death of Celilo Falls. Katie, what did he say?
Well, he raised the issue about Innu fishing sites. The Army Corps of Engineers, when it negotiated with Indian people for the floodings of Bonneville Dam, promised a number of Innu fishing sites to Native people. So they're going to flood out a bunch of sites, but they would find other sites that Indian people could use in their treaty-protected ways. There's a book about this by Roberta Ulrich, and she traces how long it takes. It takes decades, 50 or 60 years, before those sites are actually identified and made available to people. So the people that were promised them didn't ever see them.
Well, the gentleman also mentioned that they really aren't completely replacing the previous sites, neither in number nor in function. And you can take boats out from there, and I know at least one of them has restrooms finally, and I think showers too, which is great. But I went to a picnic up there one time, and it was just a partial yielding to what was offered in the treaties.
Yeah, and you know, the Army Corps of Engineers, by the time it was negotiating with Indian people about what was going to be drowned by the Dalles Dam, decided it didn't want to offer Innu sites. And there are a couple of reasons for that. The major one is that they knew that there wouldn't be fishing sites on the Columbia River anymore, really. So there wouldn't be replacement spots that they could truly replace the sites at Celilo.
And so, nothing of the nature of Celilo Falls, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. So what they offered was money instead, which, of course, was one of the things that many of the Native representatives from the four treaty tribes and from Celilo Village pointed out wasn't really a true compensation for what they would be losing.
Yeah, well, I think of a song Carly Simon sang years ago about pave paradise and put up a parking lot.
Right.
You know, it all works the same way. Well, thank you again, and I'd like to thank our listener, whose name I'm sorry I've forgotten at this point, but we do have to keep our phone conversations a little limited when we're doing radio because of the live nature of the show. I was looking through a copy of Spiliai Taimu here and ran into a memorial for Rudy Clements, and the headline says, "Clements family appreciates the support of many." Anna Clements and her family received an outpouring of support from friends and relatives on the reservation from across the state and Indian country. Anna wishes to share some of the caring words she received following the passing of her husband, Warren R. Rudy Clements. And yeah, I worked with Rudy there years ago, and trying to people on and off reservation got together to finally form the Oregon State Commission on Legislative Services. So it was an effort that took a lot of people's participation, and I was just one little piece of that whole action. But it brought me into contact with Rudy, and I think. There was some other project that we worked on together, too. Well, we know that we will miss him, and many other people will miss him, but we all are temporaries here anyhow. The great wheel moves on, and we're just making space for the one behind us. So, let's turn this music up a little bit louder, and we'll close out. I almost forgot a piece here. The commercial sturgeon fishery runs from February 1st through March 21st. The compact states of Oregon and Washington concurred with the Columbia River Treaty Tribe's proposal to open the commercial winter gillnet fishery for sturgeon from February 1st to March 21st. It's area all of Zone 6. Restrictions are all standard river mouth and dam sanctuaries remain in effect. Gear, no minimum mesh size. Allowable sales, sturgeon between 4 and 5 feet from the Dalles and John Day pools and between 45 inches and 60 inches from the Bonneville pool may be sold or kept for subsistence. Salmon, steelhead, walleye, shad, and carp may also be sold. Platform caught fish may be sold during open commercial periods. Please note, the fishery may close earlier in any pool if that pool's harvest guideline is reached prior to March 21st. If you have any fishing enforcement problems or need assistance or information day or night, contact the Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Enforcement Office, 4270 West Cliff Drive, Hood River, Oregon, phone 541-386-6363 or toll-free 800-487-FISH or 487-3474. Please consult your Tribal Fish and Wildlife Committee for additional details on tribal regulations. And please wear your life jackets for safety. Yeah, we get too many people drowning out there, and it's a good idea, even though it may be uncomfortable. So notice that Brent Secunda, a shaman from the Wechol people, is coming up this way again. I've got a couple of notices here. And one is in February 24th through 26th, a weekend seminar in Seattle, Washington. But if you want to know more about that, give us a call. There is a substantial fee, and we won't mention that on the air, but we can talk to you after 3 o'clock on the regular line here or in Indian World or KBOO. Well, time is running out, and it's been interesting and fun. Oh, I know there was something else I wanted to mention. We received a gift. Very strangely, I just picked up another piece of paper. We have all kinds of orders from headquarters, so to speak, down here at the station about this, that, and the other. And something came up about the pledge drive and getting thank you gifts together, and one of our listeners had told me in advance he was going to do this, and he his name is Jeremy Moody, Jeremy C. Moody, and he's down there at Sheraton, Oregon, so he couldn't do certain other things and decided to do a piece of art for us, and we've seen his work before. He does beautiful Northwest-style art, and offered us a lovely piece of art to offer as a premium in our upcoming pledge drive toward the end of March. So that's something in the way of Indian material that you can look forward to as a premium during that pledge drive. And I'd like to thank Jeremy. Well, let's see if we can do it. We'll get that on the computer, and maybe his lady friend will be able to see it. I'd like to thank Louis Shoa, who's been in the background here helping some, and John Mackey, who's also been helping. And Louis has been around for a while, but he's been learning a little bit more about how to run the board and help us when we need help. Sometimes we get stuck and don't know which button to push, and get us all together and we can usually figure out something. Well, you've been listening to Indian World, and we're going to be winding down here soon, and we're going to hear another piece of music, and I'd like to ask you to keep listening. We'll be on in 2 weeks if all goes well. In between times, there is Eugene Johnson with Metakwe Yasin on the in-between Thursdays. Maybe he thinks we're on the in-between Thursdays. But at any rate, he'll be around in between, and he'll bring you some interesting thoughts to deal with and some more music, too. This is your host, John Talley, saying thank you and keep listening to your community station, KBOO.
Word of the Day, highlighting one of America's many indigenous languages. This word comes from the language spoken by the Tlingit Indians of Alaska's southeast region.
Today's word is Ish, which means father, and is spelled E-E-S-H. A person might say, Do Ish Awawaita, which means her father is sitting there. That is today's Tlingit word of the day, Ish, Ish, father.
Native Word of the Day is a production of National Native News with support from Public Radio International, the Alaska Humanities Forum, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Humanities, a federal agency. For more information, visit our website at www.knba.org.
This is the community calendar for Thursday, February 9th. There will be a panel discussion tonight at 6:30 p.m. called The Role of Higher Education in Community Food Systems. This will be held at the Portland Community College Rock Creek Campus Event Center at 17705 Northwest Springville Road in Portland. Panelists will include representatives from the Governor's Office, Portland State University, New Seasons Market, and others. And then on Friday, February 10th, from 1 to 2:45 p.m., there will be a workshop called Sustainable Campus Food Programs and Curricular Applications. And then from 3 to 4:30 p.m., there will be workshops on Learning Gardens and Student Initiatives. Again, this is held at the Portland Community College Rock Creek Campus Event Center. All events are free and open to the public. No advance registration is necessary and parking is free. For more information, contact Jennifer at 503-977-4419. Tazo welcomes submissions for its juried Waste Not art competition, exhibition, and auction to benefit Scrap and Disjecta. Emerging and professional artists, designers, and architects in the Pacific Northwest are invited to create original works of art using a minimum of 75% recycled, reused, and found materials and submit their creations to a selection committee for inclusion in the exhibition and auction. The submission deadline is Monday, February 13th. Selected works will be displayed and auctioned at the event on March 4th, 2006. Proceeds from the exhibition's live and silent auction of artwork will be split between the individual artists and the event's beneficiaries, Scrap and Disjecta. Scrap is the School and Community Reuse Action Project, and it promotes creative reuse and environmentally sustainable behavior by providing educational programs and affordable materials to the community. Disjecta is an outlet for artists of all disciplines and provides an art center for emerging concepts in visual and performing arts in the Inner East Side of Portland. For official rules, submission guidelines, and more information, please visit www.wastenotart.com or contact Amy Bourne at 503-736-9005, extension 2248. If you are a member of a nonprofit or community group and would like to have an upcoming event considered for an announcement on this program, please email kboocommunitycalendar@gmail.com or post to our website at kboo.fm. You've been listening to the Community Calendar for Thursday, February 9th. This is Alicia Olson for KBOO listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.
The time is 3 p.m. The time is 3:01 p.m. And we don't see any signs of our African component, so we'll play some more music until they get here.
Discovered America. How the hell could man discover land when he got a brother waiting for him?
Influence.
Sayada. Ahagwini. Iwakdani.
One person can make a difference. Every act has a significance. Every act is spiritual.
Time is 3:10, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
Greetings. This is Contessa de la Luna. The Cable Board of Directors will meet this Friday. That's right, this Friday. Support and be an active member listener by attending the Cable Board of Directors meeting this Friday evening at 6 p.m., 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, one half block south of Burnside, darling. Kiss, kiss.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 16th annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 3rd through March 4th. This year's festival highlights include films from Angola opening and closing the festival, and an examination of the African legacy in Mexico through screening, symposium, and community conversation. Additionally, there will be a spotlight on AIDS in Africa, Women Filmmakers Week, and appearances by some of the directors at the film festival. For more information, visit AfricanFilmFestival.org or call 503-244-6111, extension 3630.
Jump if you get belly to put on. Drink if you get belly to take on. Enjoy yourself as you think you sabi. Enjoy yourself as you think you sabi.
Exactly.
Hello.
Hello.
no huragan. Whoa! If you go, we see more. I think, oh, and you get a good, 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 good,